Dude.
What's up?
Hey.
I feel unabandoned.
Explain.
Nah. Talk about it later.
Hi.
I miss you.
Well, I was out for a couple of weeks.
Well, I saw you yesterday.
Yesterday was good because Andrew and I had a work call. And usually our work calls surprisingly end with us being like, all right, see you later. Like, we don't just sit there and go into ADHD land, but we had stuff to talk about yesterday.
Yeah, I had to fill them in on the news, what was happening in the world.
We had a little gossip sesh. Celebrities.
Did we get to know what celebrities it was about?
It was about the FS1 lawsuit. We'll just leave it at that.
And we talked to Jimmy Butler.
Oh, yeah, Jimmy. I was just reading about him today. I was like, his name popped up on my algorithm this morning. I was like, what's old Jimmy doing? Had to check out the NBA Circle Jerk Reddit.
They're listening.
It's my favorite Reddit.
Speaking of celebrities, we have Jason Sweat with us. Author, conference organizer, speaker, Saturn CI creator. What else are you doing these days?
Any lawsuits? No lawsuits, thankfully.
He's sending me letters, dude. He's the only person that doesn't send me junk mail.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, have you guys been enjoying your monthly nonsense?
I do.
Every time I get it, I clear out 10 to 15 minutes and sit down and read it.
I have the USPS like that sends you like a picture of your mail every day. And as soon as I see the letter, I know it's time to go open my mailbox. Because I have like a community-wide mailbox thing that I have to go do. So I'm not about to walk out there for no junk mail. So,
because you don't want to walk out there, or you're like nervous you're going to run into someone?
It's more like I walk past the mailbox or drive past it all the time, and I know there's nothing in there but junk mail. So,
is it the fact that the junk mail's building up?
No, I take it out every month. It's just like, why would I open the mail if there's nothing in there?
I had a PO box and I had overflow of just junk mail. I don't actually think I ever got one legitimate thing in that PO box.
Most of it's not even addressed to me.
So to fill you in, dear listener, on what this is all about.
Wait, don't talk to our listener like that. No, I'm just kidding.
I have a snail mail newsletter that I send every month. It's called Nonsense Monthly. I think people like it. I started it on the premise that people would find it a small delight to find something in their mailbox that's not junk mail. And I think people do enjoy that. And if you want to get some mail from me, dear listener, you can go to nonsensemonthly.com. It's like a yearly subscription thing. But I write about programming and I write about a whole bunch of other wacky stuff that doesn't have anything to do with anything.
Can you write next month about how you mail them out? Because I'm just curious if it involves you going to like a Kinko's or you have a printer and you're just printing these all out. I need to know more about what's happening here.
It's not very interesting. I just print them out in my office here and then I fold up the letters and stuff the envelopes.
And then you have to go buy stamps.
Yeah, dumbass.
Yeah, I buy like $500, $1,000 worth of stamps at a time and then just use them for the next few months.
So how much ink is it costing you? That's the real question.
I don't know. Maybe a few $100 a year.
Nah, that's not bad. I had to buy ink recently and I was like, dude, are you serious?
They put us on a freaking subscription for our ink.
Yeah, ain't no way, bro.
The price they want for ink outside of subscription is insane. It's smart, but I hate it. Now I got Big Brother watching how many times I print something.
Anyway, I think we're here to talk about SincRuby, which is a conference that I know I've enjoyed multiple times in the past.
Oh yeah, how did you like it last year?
I really enjoyed it last year.
Did you get a lot out of it?
Yes, I had a great time in Vegas.
When you didn't have a ticket to the conference?
Hey man, I had to work.
Sorry, continue.
So Jason, this year SincRuby, what are the dates? Tell people what they can look forward to.
Well, it's April 11th and 12th or thereabouts. SincRuby.com has the dates. You would think that I would know the dates, but SincRuby.com has definitely the correct ones. And you can hang out with four handsome gentlemen named Jason, Chris, and Andrew, three of whom are speaking. Sort of leave you out, Andrew.
It's fine.
What do you get for sneaking in 2024?
Yeah, take that.
And we got some other speakers too. Irina Nazarova, CEO of Evil Martians. Irina and these two guys here, Chris and Jason, they're kind of the three superstars of the speaker lineup.
They usually are.
Yeah. And Jason has a world record for most SincRuby talks given, and he is the only person in the history of the world to give a talk at every single Sin City Ruby that's ever happened.
Jason, are you going to wear your Elvis costume this year?
I returned it all to Amazon when I got home. I got to find something else. So
buy it again.
I got to. I can't balling repeat.
Balling on a budget, dude.
No, Sin City is my favorite Ruby conference. It is partially due to my love for Las Vegas. Like, I look up above my desk and I have a shelf of Vegas stuff. But outside of that, it is the perfect size conference. It is the perfect blend of technical talks. And it is also the best place just to hang out with everyone.
And it's within driving distance. So much
to do. It is within driving distance of you.
That's why it's my favorite one.
It's within driving distance of anybody who has an appetite to drive however far it is. I've driven there, so driving distance for me.
I think Marco would have had a hard time driving to Vegas last year.
That's true. Driving distance within North America.
I think sometimes when the certain parts of the year, you can drive like from Alaska to Russia, right? So
really?
There's technically like a land bridge there that surfaces during certain tides, I think.
Jason Sweat, how big is an eagle's talon?
I don't know.
It's big enough to hold a human's fist on some eagles.
Wow. Yep. Oh, that's so pretty big. Some eagles.
Well, not every eagle.
By the way, guys, yesterday I was driving down the road and I saw a bald eagle.
That's dope.
I had freedom just rushing through my veins.
I would have taken a picture.
Yeah, I didn't have a chance to.
Was it big?
Yeah. But well, I mean, where
its
we live,
talon can
it's
hold
not,
a human fist.
Yeah. Did it wrap around your fist?
It could have given you a fist bump, dude.
Yeah.
That I'd would probably be a real like moment.
One bald eagle a year or so around here. So it's not that rare.
That's dope. Didn't know that. Anyway, back to Vegas.
So, question.
We made a real quick hop from Las Vegas to bald eagles
with the stop in Russia.
So, how many tickets are available to purchase this year?
There is a maximum of 100 attendees, including speakers.
Oh, dang.
And there's 7 speakers, and Andrew has already bought a ticket also. So you can do the math on that. Yeah, it's a very small conference. And Jason, I want to ask you, you said it's a perfect size conference. What makes you say that?
Both years before, but specifically last year, I think I got to talk to like almost everyone there. And if I didn't, it's just because our paths just didn't cross, but that's pretty rare at that size.
It's big enough where you don't feel like overwhelmed being like next to the same people every single day, but it's small enough that you feel like you can have a one-on-one conversation with every single person.
Yeah, you can still bounce around like from different groups and stuff. And also what helped with that was the start of the conference. You had everybody like randomly swap up into different groups and do these like kind of different activities. And the introvert in me was like, what the hell is this? And then when it was done, I was like, oh, this was perfect. Cause there was just like, again, 5 people I talked to, learned about in 5 minutes that I probably wouldn't have really gotten the chance to. So it was cool.
Yeah. That makes me really happy to hear. Cause that was exactly the idea behind that. So what we're talking about is what I call forced socialization. At the beginning of the first day, I divided people into random groups of like 5 people or something like that. And I gave some seed topics, like say your name, where you work and where you live or something like that. And then people went around and did that. And then the conversations kind of went from there. And it seemed to go pretty well in that I like let people loose on that. And by the end of 10 minutes or whatever amount of time we gave people, like, people were still just chatting away. Like it never stalled or anything like that. And then after the first one, we rotated again and got into different groups. I was only planning to do it the first day, but people liked it so much that we did it at the beginning of the second day also. And we're definitely going to do that in 2025 also. People told me afterward, they were like, I was like pretty uncomfortable when we did that, but I'm actually really glad that we did that because it like forced me to talk to some people and have some conversations that I probably wouldn't have had otherwise.
I loved that. Also, the timing's good. I mean, you have even less speakers this year than before, right?
Mm-hmm. A lot fewer speakers, actually. We're going to do bigger time for breaks. So last time lunch was maybe like an hour and a half or something like that. And there's not lunch on site. We just let people loose and they go grab lunch wherever they want. And with where it's at in Las Vegas, you can just like walk out onto the strip and just find a place to eat really easily. But it's not necessarily like super fast. And last time I was late coming back to my own conference from lunch and they had to start without me. And so I want to give people some more slack this time. So we're actually going to give like 3 hours for lunch or something like that. So if you want to go like see how many Bud Lights you can drink before you have to come back to the conference, you can go do that, get into whatever you want to in that 3 hour gap and just not have to have your eye on the clock the whole time. So yeah, that's why we're doing fewer speakers this time.
That's cool. Yeah, I didn't really think about that. There are a ton of places to eat, but they are not quick. Especially historically when it was at the Tropicana RIP, it was like 10 minutes just to get out of the Tropicana because of that long hallway, cut through the casino, and then you're at the end of the strip. So then you still have to get to where you're going to eat.
Dude, when they tore that down and I saw how much asbestos was in that, it actually made me worried for my life. And then Jason gaslit me into believing that wasn't a problem, but I am still worried about that.
Did I? That didn't seem like something I would do. I mean, excuse me, gaslight you, sure. I don't know. When it comes to asbestos, stuff like that,
It was either you or Drew. I thought it was you. It could have been Drew.
I mean, I tweeted that it only made it more magical, but I didn't really believe that.
The hallucinations made it more magical.
Well, doesn't a visit to Las Vegas chop a bit of time off your life any way you slice it?
I mean, starting from the time you get on the plane.
Yeah.
Head there, yes.
Just the secondhand smoke in the casinos.
Oh, yeah.
My man says as he vapes.
Dude, I used to be a smoker, so I'm very aware of how bad it is for you. I think that's why when I'm like walk into businesses that allow it inside, I'm like, really? This is bad.
Well, at Sin City Ruby, right in the conference room, you can just light right up if you want to.
All right, dude. I'm going back to cigarettes. I'm blazing Marlboros, dude.
Somebody should give a talk while smoking a cigarette. That would be a first, probably.
I'll do it.
That'd be badass. Yeah. I would not like to see you smoke. That would be a sad day for me.
I smoke cigars, but every year, at least on like one trip, I'll buy a pack of cigarettes. I'll smoke like two of them, and then I'll hit my quota for the year. It's my thing.
I think if we're being precise, you probably can't smoke in the conference room. It'd have to be like a lightning talk out on the casino floor or something like that.
A lightning talk on the casino floor is another genius idea.
And you have to smoke a cigarette when you do it. It's one cigarette's worth of a talk.
Oh,
when it gets down to the butt, you're out of time.
And no, just letting it burn out. Like, come on. If it burns out, you're done.
To smoke those really long cigarettes. Can it be hundreds? One of those? Yeah.
Dude, I smoke those in summer.
Somebody should dress up like Hunter S. Thompson for this Sin City Ruby. Costumes encouraged. Dear listener, if you're going to come to Sin City Ruby, dress up like Elvis, Hunter S. Thompson, Michael Jackson. Not because Michael Jackson is like a Las Vegas performer, but you know, there's those guys out on the street dressed like celebrities.
Yeah, I'm going to come dressed as Spider-Man, but like the Spider-Man that always has the mask off and is like on a smoke break on the strip.
It's so Tobey Maguire. I used to dress up as Spider-Man as a kid. You just reminded me of that. And Superman and a cowboy. But I still dress up as a cowboy.
I know you.
One time when my older son was like 4 or something, we went into his room and he was just sitting there quietly reading a book with the Spider-Man mask on.
I was that kid too. Yeah. It makes sense. Cool. Speaking of reading books, Jason, you just published something recently, right?
Yeah, I did. It's called Professional Rails Testing. Came out in October of 2024.
That's not your first book, right?
No, it's my first print book. So you can actually like get it on Amazon and it'll get delivered in the mail. But yeah, before that, I had a book called something about Rails testing.
Yeah.
Distant memory at this point. But I like got kind of embarrassed by my old book and I'm like, this book sucks. I'm going to write a better book. And so I wrote what I think is a better book. And I'll just real quick give you a taste of what's in it. The first few chapters, I think, are the most important concepts in the book, and that's why I put them first. The first one of these chapters is tests as specifications. So the idea that tests are executable specifications. test-driven development and why exactly do we do it the way we do it? Like everybody talks about red-green refactor, but it's rarely explained like why do we do it in exactly that way and what does it mean and all that stuff. Writing meaningful tests is the next chapter. So that's a big one. What does it mean to write a test that is meaningful versus a test that's maybe pointless or whatever? And then the last one I'll mention for now is writing understandable tests. A lot of places have a test suite where the tests are there, but they're not very easy to understand. And I feel like a lot of people don't give a lot of thought to not just making the test do its thing, but actually making it so when you lay eyes on the test, you can understand at a glance what the test is doing.
Those were all things I hugely struggled with when I tried to teach myself testing back in high school or whatever. I'm just learning how to code in general. But then everybody online is like, well, you need to write tests. And I was like, okay. But then I'm looking at the test and I'm like, so how do I just write the test that proves that something worked? And I hadn't even wrapped my head around the idea that I needed to here is a hard-coded example. Give this input, get this output, and it will always be the same. I ended up trying to write the same kind of code in my test as I was doing in the actual code. And it was like, well, that's not testing anything. It's not making any case. Input and output must always be the same. And those little conceptual things are pretty tough when you're just trying to learn how to code in the first place, because testing is a lot different. All those philosophies that you have to learn about writing a good test and even what the heck that looks like, that takes a lot to wrap your head around, I feel like.
Well, and something that should be said is that most testing educational material that's out there, I'm sorry to say, is garbage. It's just really bad. And most of the examples you'll find in the test suites you'll encounter in your workplaces are frankly not very good examples. You have these poor educational materials and then these bad examples. And then at the same time, everybody stressing to you how important it is. And it's just kind of a recipe for frustration. And so no wonder people find it hard to learn. But I think the most important idea in testing is the idea that tests are executable specifications. So what I mean by that is when I am called in to help teams get better at testing and stuff like that, I often find that in addition to needing help with testing, they need help with some other things that are upstream of that before they can do testing. A big problem with a lot of programmers is they don't decide what they're going to do before they do it. They get some idea or they have some vague instruction for somebody to do such and such, and then they just start typing. But in order to be able to write tests, you have to first decide with a certain degree of specificity what it is you're going to do. A lot of people skip that step and they just start writing code and very quickly get confused. And they're like, hang on, what even am I trying to do right now? So the idea is to write down what you intend to do. Write down a specification. It can just be in English. And I give some examples in the book. A parser of a mathematical expression. Let's say, for example, when I have the expression 2 plus 2, my parser will turn that into a tree where the root is the plus operator, the left child is 2, and the right child is also a 2. So that's a specification. It doesn't have to be expressed in terms of code or anything like that. It's just deciding conceptually, what do you want to do? And so you can write that down and then you can turn it into a test, which is just an encoded version of your specification. And then once you have your encoded specification, then you can make the code work. With TDD, test-driven development, it's often tough for people because they're like, how am I supposed to write my test before I even know what my program's going to do? It's like, well, you can't. You have to decide what the program is going to do before you write the test. And testing or no, that's the step a lot of people skip is, again, deciding with specificity what it is that you're trying to do.
Until now, observability was metrics, logs, and traces. It was reliability budgets, error rates, and latencies. It was big acronyms on a central dashboard. In short, it was what the ops team cared about, not the developers. but Honeybadger is changing that. Of course, you need the big picture, the single pane of glass that lets you know what your system is doing and that it's operating normally. But individual users matter too. User experience is more than just a line on a dashboard. Honeybadger's observability platform lets you drill down into the details, into the individual user experiences that drive product development and your business forward. It helps you understand your product and your users as much as it does your systems and performance. Honeybadger's free developer plan includes error tracking, uptime monitoring, custom charts and dashboards, and 50 megabytes per day of structured event logging. To get started, visit honeybadger.io. That's www.honeybadger.io.
So I've been trying to do that a little bit more this year of like taking like a task that I'm given and breaking it down in steps. But what I often find is that once I get deeper into it, the task that I originally came up with during my research no longer makes sense. And it feels like wasted time because it's like, oh, well, because then I realized that this was happening. I had to pivot. I couldn't do this thing. I had to do it this way, et cetera, et cetera. What kind of advice would you give for someone who's going through something like that?
Yeah, the first advice I would give is a mindset shift. You mentioned waste, and it makes me very sad because a lot of developers and managers try to be efficient and they see waste as a bad thing. But programming is a creative process, and creative processes necessarily involve waste. Imagine if the Beatles recorded every sound they ever produced and they tried to compose music efficiently. Their albums would be like mostly garbage with a little bit of good stuff mixed in. And so all the like 90% of songs they wrote that weren't any good, we don't call that waste. That's just stuff that didn't make the final cut. So that's the first thing I'd say about that. And let's get a little bit more specific because I'm not sure that I understand the scenario. Is it the case, Andrew, that you like feel like you have a good sense of what direction you want to go in and you start building it, but then a ways down the road, you discover, oh, wait, this thing wasn't obvious from the outset and it makes kind of a big difference to the whole picture. And now I have to like back out most of the way and almost start over. Is that the kind of scenario you're talking about?
Yeah, or just you do some research like, oh, we need to add this form. We need to do this thing. Like you start doing the research like, okay, well, I need to add the controller and you kind of make a little mental list of tasks. Maybe I'm just not writing my task. I think it's a problem of the way I'm writing like these little tasks to myself. But then I start getting into the code and I realize like, oh, well, I forgot about all of this stuff and like, oh, and I have to do this thing. And suddenly I'm off my task list, which has now the rest of my tasks don't even make sense anymore because I've had to do all this other stuff. I'm a very chaotic programmer. So maybe that's just a testament to the way I work. But I often find that when I go back to like look at my task after like my Pomodoro ends, I'm like, wow, now this doesn't make sense. Like I didn't really need to do this. And like now I need to like all this other stuff. It just feels like a waste of my attention because my attention is a very limited resource.
Well, that's why they have that saying, plans never survive contact with reality. Because it's like, once you get in there, everything is like almost instantly invalid. Even though that's a waste, again, that's not a bad thing. That's just the way that it goes. And I think part of it is like where you decide to draw the line between the specification process and the build out process or whatever you want to call it. Because like I think you'll set yourself up for disappointment a lot if you say, all right, I have the plan, now I'm going to build it, and you expect it to go to plan. Like that exploratory phase continues like almost right up until the thing is done. And that's how it goes for me so much of the time. I recorded a YouTube session yesterday because I do these online meetup sessions every week where I do live coding. And so much of the time, including the session yesterday, I start with one objective, and then about 5 minutes in, I completely abandon that objective because I run into something that tells me that I need to change my plans, and what I thought was a good idea is actually no longer a good idea, I realize, and I need to do something completely different. And to me, that's not a waste. That's just how it goes.
And then do you go back and update your plan, or do you just keep plowing through?
Yeah, I'll update the plan. To me, it's almost like plans are immutable. So like I don't really change my plans. I just like throw it out and make a new plan. And sometimes when I'm on these calls, I don't write anything down. But if I'm like doing some for real work, I'll kind of write down what I intend to do so that I can get it out of my head and onto the page so I don't have to worry about holding it in my head, because that makes it easier for me. I'm not afraid to throw away plans and throw away work and stuff like that, because I think people worry too much about being efficient. And ironically, by trying to be efficient in the minute to minute, hour to hour scale, you end up being inefficient in the bigger picture. But if you don't worry about being inefficient on the scale of hours, then you end up being more efficient on the scale of days and weeks.
Some good advice. I'll have to give it another try, because I've been resistant to it at the beginning of this year, because I've been like, well, it just feels like I can just work off my linear ticket. I'm not gaining as much value from this as I thought I would. Like, it seems like it's mostly just a scratch pad for code that I want to save. So I'll have to give it another try.
I'll say one more thing. I think most people, including myself for a long time, think of code as a medium for doing work and creating a work product. And if you add any code that you don't ultimately keep, then it's a waste. But also, code is a medium for thinking. Writing to create a work product is not the only valuable use of writing. You can also use writing just to get your thoughts straight. And even if you write something down and then you delete it, you still have benefited from that. That's how I think about that part.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Like, the thing I appreciate a lot about Rails is the terminology used in method names and class methods and whatever. You're not going to get the right words immediately. They will take some refinement and polish, and you'll need to write it 5 times before you realize, oh, what I really mean here, and it always didn't feel clear, was this other word or whatever. And then all of a sudden things start to come together. Maybe we're spoiled because Ruby is so expressive in English and not as much syntax that we have to fight with or whatever, but it really does help my brain a lot when I'm like trying to write something and make it expressive. And maybe you can't pinpoint that, like, there needs to be some other concept here, like we need to extract a class out or something. And sometimes you just feel that like frustration or whatever, but the more you write, the more you start to like pull that out and detect that. I've definitely noticed that a lot in my own writing of code.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of really good points there. I've seen a lot of people struggle because they're trying to get something right on the first try, like the right name or the right structure or whatever. And they're like sitting there not typing anything. And I always say, hey, just get something on the screen, whether it's something wrong or something right, because it's always so much easier to see something wrong and think of how it should be adjusted than to come up with something right from the first place. And I also think people shouldn't worry about being wrong, because being wrong is a guarantee. You're going to be wrong about some amount of stuff, guaranteed. And the question in programming is not how can you avoid being wrong. The question is how can you make it so you can recover from being wrong? Because again, being wrong is a guarantee. So that's why we focus on writing code that's like loosely coupled and easy to change. That's why we write tests so that we can make changes without fear of regressions, because we know we're going to be wrong. And so the question is, how do we safely correct our mistakes?
So basically, my coworker and I have been going through this phase of our lives together where we use RSpec, and we are tired of setup hell in test, where you've got 600 lets and, you know, you go to edit line 695 of a test file and the let is described in line 3. If you're in a describe block or some type of context, there's a let in between there. We found this to kind of frustrate us recently, to the point where we are like avoiding all setup. We're not avoiding setup. You have to do it, but we're changing where we do it. I'm curious. Andrew said this is an us problem. Do you see this outside or in other companies?
Big time. And in fact, on page 129 of Professional Rails Testing, in the chapter called Testing Sins and Crimes, it's an anti-pattern that I describe where you have, and I'm not saying this is exactly what you have going on because I don't know, But what I see a lot is you have a test file with a whole bunch of test cases. And then at the top of that test file is this chunk of setup data, which is basically like the union of all the setup data that's needed for all the tests. And so it's like, hang on, what setup data goes with which tests? Is this one needed for all the tests? Is this one needed for just one test? Makes it very hard to understand, and it makes the test hard to work with. A bigger picture comment on that situation, Jason, basically always when I go into a consulting situation and we look at the tests can't be cleaned up without cleaning up a lot of other stuff too. Something I say several times in this book is that a person's design skill and testing skill will move in lockstep, because your tests will influence and be influenced by the design of your application code, and your application code will influence and be influenced by your tests. They kind of advance together. What I saw with a recent client engagement is they had a lot of tests that were between like 1,000 and 4,000 lines long. And the conclusion I came to with that, which to me it was pretty clear, was that they had gigantic tests because they had gigantic concepts. If you have a user model, for example, and conceptually, the way that you conceived of a user in your application covers a lot of ground, then your test for user is going to be huge because you defined that model so broadly. And so I have a hunch, Jason, that maybe that's part of the picture, that maybe for these tests that have a lot of lets and stuff like that, the entity that it's testing is itself fairly large. And so to me, part of that solution often is to take the thing that's being tested and look for ways. So a big test is a hint that maybe the thing that's being tested is too big. And then where to go from there is usually not easy or obvious, because you have to look at that thing you're testing and saying, okay, is there like a natural, logical way to take this big thing and slice it up into a number of smaller things and end up with something that's an improvement over what was originally there? Because I'm, of course, not advocating for slicing something up just for the sake of ending up with smaller things, even if it doesn't make sense. That's obviously not good.
It checks out. Another problem, it's in a similar vein, but other than things being too big, is that too many things depend on each other. And so
that's why I said it's an us problem. It's an artifact of our architecture of our database that we have to have this much setup.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's led us to write another style of testing we don't necessarily adore either, but it is so far feels better that when you go back to a test file, you don't have to dig around. You can like at least build the mental model quicker, but the problem is still there. There's a big mental model to build.
Oh, and I'll comment also, you mentioned you've gone to duplicating the setup from test to test. I have a whole chapter about duplication in tests. It's kind of a hot button topic, maybe in programming in general, not just the Ruby community. And duplication is actually a nuanced and pretty deep topic. And duplication in tests doesn't work the same way as it does in application code. First, I want to ask you guys, it's going to sound like a really basic question, but what is duplication?
It's taking the same thing and creating another version of it in the exact same state that it exists.
Okay. When you say same thing, what exactly do you mean by thing?
Whatever the object is that we are duplicating, whether that be physical or metaphysical.
Metaphysical. Wow.
I think of it as like duplicating the same behavior.
Yeah, that's the key thing. So me personally, I didn't make a clear distinction for the longest time. And then at some point I realized that like, wait, duplication doesn't mean duplication of the same code. It means duplication of the same behavior, because you can have two pieces of code that happen to be identical, but they are not linked behaviorally. And you can have two pieces of code that are expressed in different ways syntactically, but they are the same piece of behavior. And if one changes, it logically follows that the other one needs to change too, because they're the same behavior. But in tests, a lot of the tests aren't behavior. Tests are specifications. And so it's not the same thing. Like in application code, if you have an instance of duplication and you change one but not the other, then you have a bug. But in tests, if you have two specifications that happen to be identical or very similar and you change one, it doesn't logically follow necessarily that the other one has to change, because what determines whether the application code is correct is if it satisfies the tests. But what determines if the test code is correct is if you, the human, decide it's correct. And so hopefully that makes sense. Like whatever you decide is correct for the tests is correct. You have two identical things, you change one of them. Are things fine now? Is that what you intended? Did you intend now for one to be different and the other one to still be the old way? Do you intend for them both to be updated? It doesn't work the same way as an application code where it's a logical necessity. It's just up to your discretion. So those two things operate differently.
That makes sense to me. It's a bit affirming to me because that's the kind of the way I'd started to look at it. I think I like posted about this like a month ago, but I just found myself, for example, repeating the same setup for specs because, well, they'll all have something that looks like this and I don't want to repeat myself. The point I came to was I'm doing this really for the sake of dry, but it's hurting. It's not helping. I like the distinction of these are specifications. These aren't the actual functionality that you're testing, really.
I think yeah. I might have actually picked it up from you that repetition in tests isn't a big deal. Like this has been like a more recent change, but I've basically been taking a hard stance of I'm not defining a let block at the top of my test unless every single test in this entire file is going to use that. And if it's not, then I'm not going to do that. And I'm relying much more on like stubs and mocks and doubles and stuff.
Mario and I are hardcore, like no lets. We're even careful with like describing context. Like we're trying to stay like more flat even.
Yeah, so you can't take describing context away from me.
I'm not saying don't use it. I'm just saying I don't want to end up seven describing context deep.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's where that shared setup stuff really starts to like kind of rear its head is when you start nesting and then you're like, oh, well, now it's really shared. I just need to change this one thing. It makes a big web and I don't like webs. I don't like spiders.
I don't believe in shared examples.
Oh. Do you like Spider-Mans?
There are some Spider-Men that are acceptable.
Tom Holland's was good.
Andrew, ask Jason about shared examples. Ask his opinion on that.
I feel like we have the same one, but Jason, how do you feel about shared examples in RSpec?
Fuck shared examples and the horse they rode in on.
Here, here. I don't like them. It's confusing.
Okay, so a shared example is basically a method call, but it's a weird kind of method call where it's not a method that you pass arguments to. You like define global values and then you call a method that uses those global values. The way the form that that actually takes is like in your test, you might have your lets or whatever, or define instance variables or however you do it. And then you call your shared example. And then in your shared example, it has access to whatever lets or instance variables you may have defined. And it's like, where did this stuff come from? In the shared example, where did this stuff come from? And in the test that uses the shared examples, you don't know if it's safe to mess with anything because you're like, well, can I delete this let value or is it used in one of these shared examples somewhere? It makes the whole thing just really hard to understand.
Here's a question for you. And I'll tell you what decision I made after you answer it. But I have two different modules and I have a controller that basically do the same thing, but in two different parts of the application. So I created a concern to contain all of that. Like they're literally all the same, like the same index action, same show, same update, same delete, blah, blah, blah. They're just in two different modules of the application. And I needed to write tests for these controllers. And I'm not going to like do the thing where you like create like a fake controller and then include the concern and then just write one test for that. I don't really like doing that. So I'm going to have two separate spec files for each of these controllers. Is that a case where maybe a shared example or whatever is appropriate? Or is that still a case where you're going to write the same test basically in, for each? You more so do integration tests than like unit specs on your controllers, but for the sake of this.
Well, I maybe shifted on that a little bit. So there's maybe a lot to it because I question even the premise of the thing, because maybe the way I would have gone is to create a module that gets included in both those controllers, or maybe I would have done it in a different way, and maybe that different way would have made the testing picture look different. But let's go with that premise. This touches on like a really big important concept, which is that people often seek to do testing correctly. They want to do it the right way, which I think is actually a harmful attitude, believe it or not, because wanting to do it the right way precludes this different way of thinking about it, which is in terms of costs and benefits. And that's, by the way I think about everything in programming, not right or wrong, but costs and benefits and trade-offs and stuff like that. And I think a piece of this challenge, Andrew, and tell me if it sounds like I'm interpreting this correctly, is you have two things that you want to test, but these two things are almost identical. And so it's like, do you write one test that tries to tackle both these things somehow? Do you write like two identical tests? And like neither of those things really seems all that attractive because they both have like weird drawbacks and stuff like that. Is that kind of the question?
Yeah, it's like, I don't want to use a shared example because like, again, like all the reasons we've discussed, like it removes it, like it makes it harder, blah, blah, blah. And because I'm using this concern that basically duplicates the large majority of the behavior between them, I'm like, should I just really test like one of them and just kind of test the other one? Like do comprehensive testing on one of them and just kind of like assert response, blah, 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 on the other one? Or do I basically just duplicate the tests?
So I think it might make it easier to think about if we think of a hypothetical extreme example where instead of two controllers, you have 100. And so how many tests do you want to write for these 100 controllers that are almost exactly the same? You could write 100 tests, but at some point you have one test, two tests, 50, 60. At some point, you reach a point of diminishing returns where it's like you've seen one of, and you've seen them all kind of. And so I might actually write just one test and I wouldn't worry about it even exercising those other 99 controllers because we have tested a representative sample. All right, so there's a saying, testing isn't about verification, it's about specification. It's easy to conflate automated testing with QA. You can imagine a QA person like visiting every 100 of these controller pages and being like, does this one work? Does this one work? Does this one work? And that's one kind of testing, but that's not the kind of testing we're doing when we're doing automated testing. When we're doing automated testing, the question isn't exactly, does this particular run work? We're saying like, does this machinery work? And so when there's a desire to cover everything, I think that's kind of a mindset of, does this particular run of the system work? We're not testing that. We're specifying the behavior and forcing the code to conform to the specified behavior. And we only have to do that once. And all the other 99 uses of it, those are just applications of that behavior, but we only have to specify the behavior once. Having said that, maybe for all those other controllers, I would have like a single smoke test, meaning is it horribly broken or is it not? I might do that. But I wouldn't do more than one test for that more intricate behavior because you've seen one and you've seen them all.
When I was talking earlier about teaching myself testing, the thing that I was assuming was like my test needs to make sure that every situation works correctly, which is like every single possibility, which meant that I was trying to like, I guess I have to write the same code in my tests in order to cover every single case. Thinking of it more as a QA, if I put in every single number here, do all of them work? And it's like, that's not the goal. It's actually different. It's when you have the edge cases that you know need to be handled specifically, you need an example or two of those or whatever that shows off those situations, but you don't have to test every single permutation. Ideally, you're like, covering enough to be confident on it that this will work the way we want it to. When we do find a bug, we can add another test because that's a edge case that we missed or whatever, but it's not the same as we're trying to ensure that our code is perfect. It's like we're trying to have confidence that it is going to work the way we expect it to, but it can never test every single possibility ever.
Exactly. And just to underscore that again, it's about costs and benefits. Will I pay $1 to get $100? Sure. Will I pay $1 to get 99 cents back? No, I wouldn't. I'd pay $1 to get $1.01 because that's more money.
As long as you got a lot of dollars, pays out. Yeah, it's one of those things that like you write too many tests and you lock yourself into a specific way of doing things. And like we were talking about earlier, you then prevent yourself from making change to your code because now you have to rewrite the entire test suite when behavior needs to change in your application. And a certain amount of coverage is what is required at a business level. But too much of that, where you've locked every single thing in, could make it really expensive to go and change when your boss asks you to change a process or something. I've definitely seen that in test suites at companies in the past.
Interesting. Yeah, and I want to be very clear that a lot of people have the opinion that tests lock you in. They make things rigid, when actually the exact opposite is what we're shooting for. Tests give you freedom to change the implementation. And that definitely is possible, what you've said, Chris, to write tests in such a way that it does lock you in. But I want to be very clear, it doesn't have to.
Right. And I think what I saw was like the test made assumptions of the way something was going to work forever. And then it was like every single test would implement, like, say the login changed and we added two-factor auth. And then one of your fixtures has two-factor auth enabled now. Well, you've got to go update every single test that has the two-factor auth in order to preserve those or whatever. Then we had like weird situations like that, that was like, okay, well, maybe we need a test helper or something that does the two-factor auth, and we just abstract that as a helper that's like a login thing, and we could check and see if it's enabled. And we don't have to update 1500 tests for another setup line for the two-factor auth. We've definitely run into weird things like that where it was kind of like, it would help us to do some abstraction in our own test suite a little bit to make that still run. Maybe we don't even need to do it. We could skip it in our test suite, but we explicitly have tests that do run it. Maybe an example here is like devises, the number of times it will run the algorithm or whatever. In production, we'll set it to 12 or whatever, but in test, it's like, we'll just run it once because we assume that that's tested elsewhere and it'll slow our test suite down. So you can like optimize it there. But that is a little off topic, but the idea of sometimes you can write your tests in a way that it can be really annoying to change behavior. And that's something you can totally avoid, but you do need to think about that while you're writing your tests. Because I think that's where I felt like, man, we've like locked ourselves into this behavior. You know, a big chunk of the tests assume we do these exact steps. And if that ever changes, then we're kind of screwed. And it takes a whole lot more time to go update the code and the test suite.
Yeah. And the sad thing that happens sometimes is people see stuff like that and they're like, oh, this test suite sucks, therefore testing sucks, or something like that. Or this test suite has this negative aspect, therefore all test suites have this negative aspect, when that's not actually true. It brings to mind another thing, which is that testing is like just as deep and nuanced and hard and complicated as programming itself. And it takes just as long to learn. I've been doing automated testing for like 10 years and I'm still learning. And only in the last like year or two, I've realized like deep fundamental things about testing where it's like, how did I not know this before? Like the test as specifications thing, like that didn't really dawn on me until like a few years ago. But a lot of developers don't give testing the amount of attention that they really should, because if you do give it that amount of attention, it pays back so many times over.
I totally agree. It is absolutely one of those things that is just as much something to learn as programming itself. And then you get the joy of running system tests in a headless browser where you can't actually see what's going on, or it's running in a browser, but it's going too fast and you can't even see what's happening step by step. And then it feels like a black box sometimes, like setting up CI for the first time is always a bunch of commits. Just try this, try that. That didn't work. Try this other config. And I think that leads to a lot of the frustration for a lot of people that are setting up CI for the first time. It's like, I click the button and it runs it, and then it gives me an error. And then I try another guess. I do it again. It gives me an error. And I don't have a way to like put a binding IRB in CI and pause it and go poke around and see like what is actually happening here. I feel like that was, for me, at least one of the things that made testing feel harder when I'm using CI, at least. But locally in development, it felt frustrating until I realized, well, I could just throw a binding IRB in my test suite, but also in my code. So I can make sure that the test is actually setting up things correctly, because half the time it might not be. And then the code doesn't return the right thing, but maybe it is. And then you realize that there's actually a bug in your code or something. But that feedback process can be really missing when we run in CI.
Yeah, that's true. And that's a whole can of worms that comes with all its own frustrations. I want to say something, if I may. I have to go in just a minute, but I wanted to mention real quick that what I do for a living is I work as a consultant, helping people both with testing and a lot of other things. I mentioned before that a programmer's testing skills and design skills tend to move in lockstep. And so I help people not just with testing, but with object-oriented programming, software design, and stuff like that. And then I actually work with a lot of technical leaders, so like CTOs, VPs of engineering, and stuff like that, because as Gerald Weinberg has said, no matter what the problem is, it's always a people problem. And so all technical problems stem from people issues. And so I work with technical leaders to help get those people issues sorted out so that they can get their technical issues sorted out.
Cool. Well, we appreciate you coming on the show. Is there anything else you want to mention before we wrap this one up?
I guess I should mention how to contact me. I can be reached at jason@codewithjason.com if you're interested in seeing what it might look like to work together. My book is called Professional Rails Testing. It can be found at Amazon. And all my blog posts and everything else that I do can be found at codewithjason.com.
Is that the best place to buy the book so that you get the maximum proceeds from it?
No, it's only on Amazon, actually.
Oh, it's only on Amazon. Cool.
Yeah. And once again, I'll mention, if you want to join the four of us at Sin City Ruby in Las Vegas, you can go to sincityruby.com.
Cool. Well, appreciate having you on as always. It'll be fun to see you in Las Vegas this year. And hopefully, definitely, the listeners listening, y'all will join us as well.